The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware. Welcome to the Music Room on WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark. Each week, WVUD hosts different artists to talk about the music they play and the lives they lead. Stay tuned for the Music Room on WVUD.
Mando Richard here. Thanks for tuning into the Music Room on WVUD. Tonight we've got an interview I recorded on October 8th of 2015 with the Seraphim String Quartet, Kate Ransom and Lisa Vopel violins, Esme Allen Creighton on viola, and Lawrence Stomberg on the cello. They were kind enough to invite me to chat with them. Between conducting a class for high school string students and starting a rehearsal of their own, during the course of this interview, we'll hear musical interludes from the Seraphim String Quartet, from William Grant Still's Panamanian Dances. And let's start the interview with the first movement from that piece, Tamborito.
Thank you.
You guys are doing a lot of upcoming events in the greater Wilmington area.
Well, yes, Seraphim String Quartet does play a lot in the local area, meaning the greater Wilmington area, and especially, say, from the Baltimore area up to the Wilmington area and beyond, in Philadelphia area and parts, other parts of Pennsylvania.
Coming up October 25th, you're going to be doing a show at the Trinity Church in Wilmington.
Trinity is one of our regular hosts, whom we love to play for. They got a great audience, and we're there generally twice a year. Our next concert will be Beethoven and Borodin, and William Grant Still, and hence you're playing a William Grant Still today. I think I'll go practice.
My memory is you're going to be at Trinity October 25th and again in April.
Yes, actually, we're back at Trinity in April, and things have changed around a little bit in some of our programming. So that concert in April, we're playing Mozart and Beethoven, some of the greatest late works of each composer, an E-flat quartet of Mozart and Beethoven's Opus 59, number 1 quartet, his first one dedicated to a Russian count named Razumovsky. So that's going to be a really fun and rather monumental program.
As the violist in the group, do you have any favorites about the things that you're going to be playing?
Oh, I have been itching to play that Razumovsky quartet for so long. I've been itching to play it ever since I butchered it at Juilliard in my second year. Okay, so the third movement is a slow, almost funereal, very solemn, very at times dark, at times transcendent movement. And I remember it starts with the second violin leading, and our second violinist, very dear friend of mine, who's actually now the concertmaster of the Madison Symphony, so she's recovered from this as well. She just started the piece about half speed. And at the time, we didn't know how to recover from that. And so we just played it. I mean, it's a slow, slow movement anyway. And we played it half as slow. I think it took us 20 minutes.
So you played it as a dirge?
More than a dirge, like a dripping with molasses, you know, like frozen Arctic dirge. It was horrifying.
This description makes me want to know, when's the Seraphim Quartet going to do this?
Well, we're playing that in April at Trinity. The one that's coming up on Sunday, October 25th, is going to be devoted to an early work by Beethoven and the Borodin Quartet. This is Kate talking now, and I just want to mention that the reason that we shifted our spring programming around is a very exciting one for us, which is we're going to be returning to Weill Recital Hall in March. And so, you know, it was important for us to choose carefully what we're going to play in New York, and then that caused us to shift some things around. But we're really delighted to be returning there, playing Shostakovich and Grieg, and two new works that are going to be New York City or New York premieres by a very young woman composer, Julia Adolf.
Yeah, I've seen you've been programming some of her work lately. And it's one of the things that's impressed me about the Seraphim Quartet. You play the things from the classic repertoire, but you also look like you're trying to get contemporary American composers in as well.
We think it's part of we like doing it, first of all. It's important for us, and we enjoy the process. But we also think it's important that people hear this music and that there's so much value in it. We had a wonderful, I think fairly successful recording project in collaboration with Jennifer Higdon, a Philadelphia composer, and we recorded a lot of her early chamber music that had not been recorded, and now, of course, Jennifer has just done wonderfully well and has hit the big time, as they say, so we've really enjoyed getting to know her and her music, and Julia Adolf is an old friend and colleague of Esme's from past days in New York. And so it's wonderful to be part of that collaboration with someone who's really on the rise, quite meteorically, it seems, right now. So that's exciting for us. And we just love the collaboration with a living composer. So we can actually ask them what they mean by things that they write.
Asking the composer, what do you mean by this? You can't ask old Ludwig von that, can you?
We do ask Ludwig, and we ask Wolfgang, and we ask Franz Joseph, we ask every composer as we're trying to interpret a piece, what did you mean? What was this music about? And it's ultimately, that's really our job as performing artists and interpreters, is to figure that out and deliver the content of the music, not just deliver a bunch of notes and rhythms.
Yeah, we have a quartet Ouija board that we keep in the middle of our stands, along with the scores, in case any of my students are listening. Yep, always have to have the score. No, but in all seriousness, we do actually try and, as much as we can, using even sometimes our knowledge of the composer's written works, you know, or letters or personalities or stylistic questions, and try and answer what were their messages. It adds a level of meaning to everything we do.
Lisa, I'll just ask your opinion from the violin section now. In the kind of music I play, the bass player is often the comedian. Sounds to me like the violist is the comedian in a string quartet.
We look to the violist for her wisdom.
So you can see that the violinists have a sense of humor too.
I've just been robbed of my position.
Speaking seriously, this program you're going to do October 25th, the Borodin piece is really so sweet and lovely and happy, and all of a sudden the fourth movement starts dark.
That is a good way of describing it. It's extremely varied work with a lot of characterful changes throughout the piece, actually. There's some dark moments in the scherzo as well. But overall, the overriding tone of the piece is really open, very generous, and very charming. And it was used in the famous show Kismet for those reasons.
Yeah, the end of the third movement, I just felt so happy. And here's this almost piercingly sweet note, and all of a sudden,
some very low stuff going on. But what's interesting about that, after that happens, it wanders around, and it's really sort of unsure. Sometimes I think even to the quartet, what's going to happen next? Then those very same low notes become almost like a jazz riff that starts off in the cello, and it really sounds like it goes off into someplace different and actually becomes quite happy and sunny again.
And a triumphant ending.
The thing is, we're all talking, we're just standing around here, and I think this is one of the things that makes string quartets so much fun, for me at least, is, you know, watching everybody establish eye contact and rapport.
Definitely a different vehicle for making music, and we don't have to put our heads down in the sand if there's a conductor over us, right? We get to actually communicate amongst us, which is the best part. Determining what we want to put out there based on what we've come up with decision-wise, you know, with the Ouija board as a group.
Well, I mean, chamber music really, to me, it grew out of people playing at home.
It's the ultimate conversation, and also the ultimate insight into the soul of a composer.
Yeah, I feel both like a soloist and like I'm part of this cosmic whole. You know, at any moment, there's enough ingredients there to accomplish any artistic goal. That's how I feel. There's no limit to the scale of imagination, of harmony or texture that can be created with these different voices, and yet it's so vulnerable, you know, the sound of solo instruments or duets for a moment. If you take a child, for example, who's never heard a violin be played in front of them, I mean, they'll just be mesmerized by that simple line of string sound. Even if you just play a few open strings, I mean, to me, that sort of vulnerability and personality in the sound is what makes the string quartet the king, the queen of genres. Also, if you think about a human voice, like a single person's voice, and if they're telling you something, they can have so much subtlety of inflection, and you can hear, you know, a throb or a rush or a whisper on all these incredible human details. I feel like string instruments are more equipped to create that emotion in listeners than any other instrument. And we can also become a four-person, you know, wall of sound. It feels very symphonic sometimes, depending on how certain parts of music are orchestrated. So it's like both. We get to be big and small and fragile and magnificent, depending on the moment.
I think it's really quite an experience to listen when you have a group of four people, and sometimes there can even be four equal voices. Sometimes, you know, obviously a certain voice is more important in the hierarchy, but you're able to listen to those voices in such a more clear way, I think, when you have that string sound that's such a unified timbre to begin with, but you're really picking out such specific characteristics and changes that it's such a dynamic force, each simple voice that's adding to the texture. And so, you know, whether the voices are even or whether they're really fighting with each other, it just becomes a really powerful interplay.
The other thing I love in some of the string quartets that are part of the classic repertoire is how, to use a jazz phrase, you know, like it's like it's been written to trade fours. Mm. Kate plays the theme, passes it to you. You pass it to Esme, and before you know it, Larry's sitting down on the job on the cello doing the same thing.
I think it's interesting that the organization that we belong to, Chamber Music America, and many string quartets belong to this organization. They actually have a jazz component as well, I think there's a great deal of camaraderie and of spirit between chamber music, string chamber music especially, and jazz, because there's that conversational element and this sort of passing off of things and playing off of one another. And one thing, as my colleagues were talking, I was thinking about, so the difference between doing that and, say, playing in an orchestra, especially as a string player. If I'm sitting in a cello section of an orchestra, I'm one of 12 or 15 or something like that. And so that's a different type of skill and a different type of blend. But when I'm the lone cello player with three people and they're the only ones playing their parts, there's a great deal more, I think, energy, or at least a different type of energy and responsibility in talking to each other.
Talking with each other musically.
Absolutely, musically all the time. One of the things we tell young chamber music players when we're coaching them, students that we work with, is that they have to own their sound. Nobody else is going to cover their part for them or their sound for them. It's just them alone on their part. And every millisecond of sound they make, it has to be theirs. So there's inherently a weightier responsibility when you are solely responsible for that voice.
And you raised the issue of coaching and teaching, and that's important to all of you. You're the resident quartet at the University of Delaware.
We are in our fifth or sixth year now as the resident quartet at UD, and it's great for us to be able to share what we feel and our passions about string quartet playing, and to work with these young students. For some, it's their first time playing chamber music, certainly playing it seriously and really delving into, say, one piece of music for an entire semester. And we get to talk about our experiences of what has worked and what hasn't, and get to see the spark a lot of times get lit in their eyes, and it's a great deal of fun for us to do.
Yeah, that's another passion of ours, is working not just with students at the college level, but with high school students or even younger. We'll be traveling to D.C. later this fall to work with some arts schools. We have other outreach events planned, and I mean, every different level has its own curiosities and particular energies, you know, about how they see their relationship to music, I guess. So, we love to go and perform, and then we'll probably hear some chamber groups do a little coaching.
One thing we haven't talked about yet is the modern piece you're going to be playing at Trinity on October 25th. I'm not going to try to say it in Spanish, but it looks like the Panamanian dances of...
Good accent.
Yep, that's what we call them too. And actually, it's not even really that contemporary. From quite 19, a while ago.
1948.
Yeah, but it's music that I think is sometimes people think of music from 1948 and suddenly think about composers like Pierre Boulez or something like that. But this is music that is really incredibly tuneful and lush and lovely. And it's music based on folk melodies that were collected by the friend of the composer, who was an ethnomusicologist, and William Grant Still, who is considered the dean of African American composers. He was interested in this type of music in this region down in Panama, and he wrote these lovely pieces. They also are sometimes played for chamber orchestra, so string quartet is not the only version of this music. But he takes sort of these indigenous tunes that have a little bit of Latin American influence and a little bit of African influence. Just they're actually loads of fun to play, and we even get to do things like rapping on our instruments with our knuckles every once in a while.
Yes, who is the one making those tambourine noises?
All of us.
We all share around different effects. We share them around different effects in the rhythm section. It's a rhythm section of four.
That's nice. I mean, about that is it fits in, even though it's 1948, it fits in with what composers have been doing for a long time, working in folk themes.
That's definitely true. We just performed Bartok's Sixth Quartet most recently at Cabrini College, and talk about somebody who's collecting melodies from all over and turning them into his own, you know, masterpiece. Bartok's a good example. And in that same concert, we performed Grieg's G minor quartet, which is what we're also playing in New York this March. But
You know, Grieg is a great Norwegian composer, bringing out really the flavor of those cold, cold hinterlands.
Well, I mean, I think that the whole nationalist movement in art and music, which in music you can trace it back before Dvorak even, you know, to Liszt doing Hungarian-style music and so forth. But I think the nationalist movement really has drawn out of many, many, many composers from every continent, every country you can think of, a foundational basis in indigenous music or folk music and rhythms from their native land, whether it's Smetana or Shostakovich or Dvorak, or even Beethoven taking Russian themes and borrowing them, paying homage to maybe a patron, for example. This is really at the root of so much Western music.
Or I even think we could go earlier, think of J.S. Bach taking Lutheran folk hymn tunes, essentially, and orchestrating them for use in the services, but then working them into his bigger, large-scale works. So the idea of this tuneful, and tuneful in the sense that anybody can sing it, and so when we recognize a song or, you know, a piece of a song that is something that we could own, sort of the audience could sing it. They feel like, oh, this familiarity or this, I used to listen to folky inspired things and feel like, oh, I want to sing it. You know, it's a very inviting, charming piece, and those sorts of melodies give, I think, the audience a really strong connection to what we're playing. And then, of course, William Grant Still, writing the Panamanian dances, was just a master orchestrator and really creative textural composer. So on top of those folk tunes and all their, you know, resonance for us and towards the audience, we have the sophistication as well and the richness of his harmonic language. It sounds sort of, you know, I mean, maybe less so today given the advent of globalization, but it could sound a little more exotic, you know, in comparison to the traditional Western classical canon from earlier years.
You know how people like to say the expression, you are what you eat? Well, maybe when it comes to composition, you are what you speak.
I speak Panamanian.
You speak Tasmanian devil.
It's about time for you all to get to rehearse, and I really appreciate you taking time out here, but we should plug your website.
Seraphin Quartet, right? .org.
Seraphin,
S-E-R-A-F-I-N, Quartet, .org. And so Seraphin is actually that word is Sanctus Seraphin, the great violin maker. So we are named after him because Kate's violin was made by him. And it's an amazing instrument and seems very worthy of having a quartet named after him.
And now everybody in the quartet has an 18th century instrument to play.
That is correct. The other three instruments in the group are made by the Testore school of the same era and area.
Yeah, they have so much tone quality in common. I'll never forget the first time I tuned my A to Larry's cello, and I played my A, you know, to compare with his, and I felt like the sound just disappeared into his sound. Like, they were so related. They were like family, you know. It was like looking in the mirror at your long-lost cousin and being like, oh my gosh, our ears are the same. Or our noses are all crooked. My nose is crooked too. I feel so loved. That's how I felt.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Again, our thanks to the Seraphin String Quartet for appearing on The Music Room here on WVUD. Kate Ransom and Lisa Vopel, violins. Esme Allen Creighton, viola. And Lawrence Stomberg, the cello. You can find out more about this and other interviews by going to The Music Room's website at sites.udel.edu/TMR. Tune in every Tuesday night at 6:30 p.m. to WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark for another episode of The Music Room.